I'd like to begin by offering a slogan that could represent this practice. And the slogan is, "Be still and gaze upon everything kindly." Be still and gaze upon everything kindly. And maybe the slogan is instructions, or maybe it's the goal. Some people, the idea of being still is a oppressive idea. And it has connotations of being limited and held and frozen, contained, restrained. But if that's the case, it's worth kind of considering a little bit other ways of being still. For me, I think of the stillness that sometimes exists at dawn, kind of just before the sun is rising, someplace out in the woods or in by a lake or something. Sometimes there's a kind of a high quality stillness there. Everything is still. And it feels so open and free and full of potential and a certain kind of alive or safe, wonderful. The Buddhist tradition puts a lot of emphasis at times on having an inner stillness, something, inner unshakableness. The mind not shaking or quaking, moving. And we have these wonderful, or not so wonderful, metaphors we use of the mind going off, the mind getting lost, bringing the mind back. It's a metaphor. The mind doesn't go anywhere. But we have this idea that that's kind of our feeling or metaphors, and so then we kind of live in the metaphors as if that's the way the mind is. But is there a place of stillness, sweet, nurturing, place of being still, from which we can gaze kindly, so that all the currents and the winds of life, that they don't push around or don't influence the still place, or place of equanimity or peace. A place where we could stand in the middle of all things. We can stand in the middle of fire, turmoil, joy and peace. We can sit with it, and something inside can be contentedly still, not needing to go forward or back or to get or get away, just here. And to gaze kindly. So this path of purification, path of shedding what's extra or not needed, It's a path in some way of simplification, simplifying ourselves. And the first purification is that of virtue, which is the shedding of harm, shedding of so many of the ways in which we cause harm to the world around us, to others, but also how we harm ourselves. So that one of our primary needs can begin to be met. Because the Dharma is meant to meet our primary needs as human beings. And one of the needs is to be safe. And, you know, a lot of people need to be safe from themselves. So to find some ability to somehow be a safe person. The Buddha once said, make yourself safe for all beings. Make yourself safe for all beings. And I'd like to think that all includes self. And then there's the purification of mind. And I think of this as meeting. One of the great needs it meets is a need to belong. Human beings have this very deep, we're social animals, and being connected to others and being connected to this world and feeling like we belong, feeling like we're not alienated or disowned or don't belong is very important. And how concentration, the samadhi, can function is that we learn how to belong to ourselves. So that all the parts of us who we are have a place, in a way, in a certain kind of way of belonging, or becoming whole, or becoming integrated. The opposite of samadhi is to be fragmented. To be so agitated, we're spinning out and going in different directions at the same time, and kind of jagged or broken up or partial. The only part of us is included. The only part of us is known. And I think of the healthiest kinds of samadhi as the kind of samadhi that is really welcoming and including of all who we are. And if we include all of who we are, then we don't get the bliss of samadhi right away. Because sometimes we have to include some of the things that have been disowned, or some of the things we haven't really resolved and dealt with. And so all kinds of things can bubble up. But to have this principle, this idea that in a certain way samadhi is welcoming and come here. Gather together. Let's be friends. Let's be together here, all the different parts of us. And I think I have this suspicion that we have a deep need to belong. And my suspicion is that we can't really belong very well in a stable or secure or the way that really touches the heart. Can't really belong to the world or to others until we belong to ourselves. That's what I suspect, partly because if we don't belong to ourselves, what is there to belong to others? We don't have much to offer. We only offer part of who we are, so others maybe can't really see all of who we are, and they can't welcome all of who we are. And one of the functions of samadhi is to have confidence. To kind of be present in a confident way. And it isn't that we have to force ourselves to be confident, but it's one of the things that as people get more concentrated, more stable, more here, there's a certain kind of energy that arises, kind of a natural energy from it, within, a certain kind of strength, a certain kind of confidence. Partly because as we gather in and get integrated and get settled and simplified in the absorption of this moment, a lot of the forces of that are the lack of confidence quiet down, fall away, part of this purification process. And then we come to the third purification. And this also, I believe, I think of as satisfying, meeting a very important human need, and that's the need for truth. Need to feel like we're in touch with what's true. And this purification is called the purification of view. And it turns out that in the ancient language of Pali, the word that's translated as view has the same double meanings as the English word of view. So a view in English can mean an opinion, a philosophy, a point of view, a world view that we have inherited from our culture, society, family, religion. So it's kind of like a philosophy or idea. But view can also be, there's a beautiful view off the side of the mountain, meaning that you can see really well. You have a clear view of the ocean from some places around here, meaning that you can see the ocean. So view also means to view, to see. And then in Pali, there's a third meaning of view, of the same of his word that's Pali word for view, and that it also means here and now. Maybe here and now is what you're seeing when you really see. Maybe that's why the same word is used. So a purification of view is not to kind of get to the right opinion about things, but rather to shed so many of the opinions and stories that we carry with us, that we begin kind of seeing what is here and now in some really such a deep way or such a clear way that it feels like we're seeing the truth, that we are touching the truth, that we are the truth. And part of the function of samadhi, of being still, developing a clear seeing that's still and quiet, is to so we can begin doing the work, or the work gets started, of shedding a lot of the views that are not needed. And for the purposes of really going deep down into the real primary connection to the world, the reality in ourselves, there are even some appropriate views, good views, opinions, that are appropriate to at least, maybe not shed, but to put aside for the time being. So part of the function of concentration is to help with this process of purification of view. And so I want to say a little bit before I go into view itself about how this, a little bit more about this Mahasi practice. Historically, the rhetoric of those who taught it made a sharp distinction between mindfulness and concentration. And they said, in doing Mahasi, we're doing mindfulness. We're not doing concentration practice. And I think what they meant by this was that they weren't exclusively doing jhana practice, absorption practice. The reason I think that is because the whole setup, the whole form by which the Mahasi practice was presented was to support concentration. The instructions, the literal instructions were, be mindful. But then in the monastery in Burma, we weren't given any work to do. We were just told to do sitting and walking, an hour of sitting, an hour walking, an hour sitting, an hour walking. We would go to meals twice a day, maybe to a Dharma talk, maybe to an interview. Besides that, sitting, walking, sitting, walking. And the teacher Upandita was kind of strict. We mostly practiced alone, so I practiced in my room. No one, as far as I knew, was watching us. Once upon a time, I was told that there was because it was Burma, a totalitarian regime, and we were the rare Westerners living there in the 1980s. I was told there was a government spy watching the Westerners meditate. So we didn't know. No one was kind of conventionally watching us. So no one knew how much we were sitting, doing sitting meditation, walking meditation. But every day, 6 days a week, we would come for an interview with Upandita. And the first thing we had to tell him was, in the last 24 hours, I sat for 8 hours and walked for 6. And depending on how many hours those added up to, his eyebrow would either rise or not rise. And if Upandita's eyebrow rose, that was not good. He was a tough guy. And this eyebrow was enough to get the message. So we were accountable to, I've always wanted to keep that number high as possible. So once a week we didn't have our interview. So the 24 hours that was a gap for the interviews, that's when I did my laundry. So I can keep the number up. So what I'm telling you this story is that, this was supportive of really settling in and not getting distracted, not have a lot of other input into the system, just keeping the continuity, going, 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 being there. And there was no talking to anyone, no work, as I said. And then this idea of doing things slowly was also a concentration practice. It takes a certain concentration to keep going slow, a certain intentionality in being there. But also it's a way of kind of staying intimate with experience. And I think of concentration practice has a lot to do with intimacy. Some people really love the intimacy part of practice, really being connected and being here. And some people don't want to do mental noting because they feel they're going to lose some of that intimacy of just being with stuff. And so slowing down, and then to really be there, to be in the fullness of each thing that we did. And then Pandita would ask us a mindfulness question when we came in for the interview sometimes, but it was a question that really, to answer it, we had to really be attentive and continuously attentive all the time. It has concern concentration. So he might ask, coming in for the interview, and don't worry, I'm not going to ask this. I don't think. I shouldn't have said that, I guess. He'd come in, and I'd sit down, and he would say, what were you mindful of? What did you note as you came through the door of my room. What door? I'm so concerned about the interview and what we're going to talk about, and you know, I wasn't. Well, come back tomorrow. You know, or he would ask, when you got up from your meditation seat to go walking, what did you note? And you had to kind of be able, you're accountable, and you had to say, well, I noticed that the intention to stand, I noticed my arm reaching down to my side, I felt the contact of the mat against my hand, I noted it as contact and warmth and softness, and then I lifted up my knee, I noted it as movement, and I felt the smoothness of my knee, and then I had the intention of bringing up the other knee, and I took my hand and grabbed my knee, and then I pushed myself up, and very slowly I can feel my knees lifting and my back straightening, and feel the hardness of against the floor. And Vinita is just sitting there. I'm talking, saying this, and the translator is translating it. And he was usually reading his book. I think it was his technique, to Burmese technique of not preventing all kinds of projections or preventing all kinds of ways it gets complicated. He just wanted to just deal with the practice. And so, you know, you had to, what he was teaching was pay attention, not only pay attention all the time, but pay intimate attention to what was happening. What did you note when you were brushing your teeth, he would say. What? I didn't brush my teeth. I mean, that's not the practice. Everything was the practice. Everything. The only one that I could never get was, he wanted to know sometimes, did you fall asleep on the out-breath or the in-breath? And some people say they could do that, they notice that, but I'm not one of those people. I tried that for years and decided that that's, I'm not built constitutionally for that one. Maybe or something. And so eating, say that you have a bowl in front of you and you have a spoon or something. And so, and this is not supposed to be a drag to do this. It's supposed to, hopefully it comes alive for you. And it's kind of a samadhi. So it's, you know, it's intimacy and this kind of belonging to everything and being here, being just this. So the mind is not fragmented. The mind is not being reinforced to think about other times and other places and caught up in its stories and ideas. To simplify things. And so you might say, okay, I'm going to have my soup. So I'm going to, okay, I'm reaching, and I touch the bowl. And as I touch the bowl, I feel, or this one, I feel it's cold. I feel the cold. I feel the smoothness. I feel the sharp kind of corner of the edge. And as I just feel it for a little while. And as I feel it, it's kind of curious to see how awareness, how the sensing kind of shifts and moves. First one finger, and then the palm, and then the thumb a little bit, and just kind of roams around kind of in there, I guess. And then I know that it's, I'd like to lift up the bowl. So I know that's there. So if you're doing mental noting, then you note intention. And then lifting, I'd say lifting, and as I say lifting, I'd really feel the kaleidoscope, the flow or something of sensations that happen as I lift. So I'm lifting up, I feel the weight of the bowl, I feel a tightening in my forearm, then the sensations move up to my elbow, and my elbow feels a little bit tight and contracted. And I lift it up higher, and my upper arm begins to get activated and pulled in. And then I started feeling my shoulder blades and my shoulder and then my middle of my back. All these things kind of ripple through. And all I said was lifting, lifting, lifting. Lifting isn't that important, just kept me there. And I could feel this kaleidoscope, this ripple through. And it's not meant to be a lot of work. And it's not supposed to, you're supposed to know to every little sensation like that. But it's kind of like to, you know, see the ripples. It'd be kind of like being at the edge of the ocean here and feeling very relaxed and peaceful and watching the waves wash across the sands, coming and going, coming and going. And you see all kinds of details. You see that in each wave there are those little shorebirds with long legs that rush out with the waves and they rush back in. You see the waves crashing, you see the foam, and you see the foam, and the waves take a little different pattern each time and come a little bit further up the beach sometimes, sometimes not as far, sometimes big, sometimes small. It's clear you see all these things. If 3 seconds later someone said, was that a big wave or a small wave, or were there birds there or not there, which direction were they running? You could say, but you weren't thinking that, but you were registering it. In a relaxed mind, you're there. It's such a nice day. Can't believe your good luck to have a day off and just watching the birds and the waves. You can't believe your good luck that you get to sit there and watch what happens as you lift the bowl. Wow, nothing else I have to do, but I mean, it's an evolutionary miracle that we could do these things. It's like phenomenal. What it took evolution to get to this point? For us to be able to have all those sensations and all those muscles and all those things and then to have awareness of it all? It's like, whoever came up with this, you know, is a genius. Something. So what I'm trying to convey is this idea of just really being there. And not straining, not working, but let yourself almost like get the massage of all the ripples, all the kaleidoscopes of sensations you really feel. And what happens is that as you tune in more, settle down more, become stiller, you start feeling that's actually a wider and wider range in sensations. And it's also, there's more. They become more fleeting. There's more of them. Kind of just going through. And then you hold the bowl, and then it's okay. Wanting the spoon, reaching for the spoon, grabbing the spoon. Each of those words, the word is not important, it's a reminder, now feel the grabbing, lifting, feel the lifting. Be there in the fullness of lifting. From friends of mine study sensory awareness, wonderful modern form of mindfulness, and they spend hours just lifting a spoon to really get into feeling it, you know, and then it goes, and then putting it in your mouth, swallowing. And my custom that I did is when I'm really on retreat and doing this slow thing, I will put the utensil down on the table while I chew and swallow. So I'm really be there for the chewing and swallowing, because otherwise, I have such a habit, it's my true nature to eat fast. So I will put the food in my mouth. And kind of before I've even started to chew it, I'm like going for the next, you know, I'm just like, so I put it down so that I can really be there and chewing. And I'm not one of those, but I've known people who have gotten really concentrated, really still eating. It's like their favorite meditation. It's just so simple. Things get so quiet. Just that. They can give themselves over they can shed all these thoughts and all that. So that's a kind of concentration practice, but it's a concentration practice that takes in not just a single point of attention, but takes in a changing flow of attention, of things that are coming in, flowing over the beach of the sands of our awareness. Things come and go. As we do that, as you know, you can, by thinking, probably appreciate that the more you can do that, the less you're thinking about other things and other places. You're just there for that. And, you don't, start sitting there eating your soup and suddenly occurs to you, I bet they produce a lot of laundry at IRC, and I wonder who's doing the laundry, and I wonder what kind of detergent they're using, and I wonder if they're using low water washing machines. And it's important to have low water washing machines, and especially since they say conserve water, and this is actually quite important, this water thing, and I wonder if I need to talk to someone here because I'm not sure, and maybe a letter to the president of IRC, and it's a big cause, water in California, and maybe a letter to Governor Brown, and what happened to the soup? Now the soup doesn't feel like it belongs to you. The soup needs to belong too, And so if you're really there with the bowl and the soup and all that, then, there's not much room to think about letters to Governor Brown, but the laundry machines at IRC, something, right? So it's a silly example, but there's all kinds of things we can be caught up as, caught up in. So purification of view has a lot to do with shedding a lot of the views that are not helpful, and some of them which are not really needed as we go in deeper and deeper. And it's a fascinating process of discovery, because a lot of the views, the opinions, stories that we live our life by are often invisible, or it just seems so natural to live in them and be involved in them that it's like breathing. Isn't that what life is telling ourselves stories, having views and opinions and ideas. So you're standing in line downstairs for the meal, and you're the last person in line, or you're the first person in line. Both of you can feel, if you just paid attention to the experience of the moment, would have a lot of similar things. Perhaps you'd feel the hardness of the floor, you feel your legs, you feel your body kind of being present and upright, and maybe if you close your eyes, you stand there, you feel the little shifts and movements of the body as you keep your balance and stay there, and maybe you feel the temperature of the room, and you feel your body breathing. Great. The person at the front might have a story. I hope these people understand that I'm standing in the front because I have to do pot washing. Because, they're probably thinking that I'm always, you fill in the blank, I'm always, that person who's, and they probably think that I'm greedy because they probably think I want the first brownie or the biggest brownie, and I wonder what they're thinking about me, and, maybe IRC shouldn't have lines like this, and we should just have numbers. And so we kind of know when it's our turn, and there's a little screen on the wall that says, number five can now come and have lunch, and then we don't have to deal with lines and people judging me and thinking about what's right. And, we tell, and the person in the back of the line is writing a letter to Governor Brown about these lines are too long, and I can't stand here in the line for all this time. I have very important things to do. I mean, I'm supposed to, be practicing all the time, and I'm supposed to be walking and sitting and really being mindful, and I have to stand this line, and it's taking away from my meditation time, my mindfulness time, and you know, this is terrible, and I'm irritated, and those are views, those are stories. And you know, or you can have the purification of you, and kind of, you know, and say, oh, these are stories. I'm swimming in opinions and views and judgments and ideas. What's really, if it's not these abstract ideas, what's really true now? I'm standing here. And in standing here, do you need anything? You're just here. Maybe it can be really simple. Maybe it's the fullness of standing at that moment. It's so full for that moment, for a few moments, you're just right there in the experience of standing that you even want to close your eyes maybe just to really be present and feel the fullness of that experience. And even the idea that you're standing in line temporarily falls away. That's even a story. Just you're here for this experience. So there's all kinds of things that come in, and as we get stiller and stiller, as we get more concentrated or more present or more mindful, the natural thing that'll happen is that we bump into the storylines, the viewpoints, the opinions, the philosophies, the worldviews that we live by. And it's kind of like there's all these layers in the mind, and as we begin settling through the layers, we encounter the next one, or the next one, or something. All these things are, you know, they show up. So they don't ordinarily are so active, or active in a conscious way. So they're there, but they're there. And sometimes this process of vipassana is called a deconstruction process. We're beginning to deconstruct so many of the stories and views, ideas we have about ourselves, about who we are, about what others, by the world, what has to happen, what we need, all kinds of things. We begin putting a question mark next to them. Do I need to be thinking about these things? Do I need to be so concerned at this moment? Or is it okay just to stand in line and do mindfulness of line standing, mindfulness of standing? Or do I need to start thinking about, you know, it's important to think these other things. Maybe they're important some places, but maybe not now. Maybe you have something more deeper you can do. And as you go deeper, some of the deeper undercurrents of views begin to show themselves. It was quite something for me to practice in Japan, in the monasteries there, and not to understand when I got there that Japanese worldview is very different than the kind of individualistic worldview that I had grown up in the West. And so I was living my life as a good individual, and then I lived 24 hours a day with a group of 30 young Japanese monks. Slept in the same room, ate, did everything together, bathed together, everything was done together. And at some point, I had the kind of an experience where I felt like I woke up in a certain way. And I woke up to the fact that we were living in different social universes. And they lived in a collectivist world where they really saw themselves as the community as the entity. And they were parts of that entity. Whereas as an individual, I saw myself as the entity that somehow was working with other entities. And I didn't feel one was right and one was wrong. I just thought these are different ways human beings have organized themselves in order to get along, to find out how to cooperate or something. But did it put a question mark behind my individualistic worldview. I'd never seen it. And then as I kept practicing, especially when I started doing Vipassana practice, I started seeing this over and over again, how much my idea of as an individual, as an autonomous, independent individual, was kind of a worldview that I operated under. And I discovered it was possible, at least temporarily, to put that to rest. And there was just the smoothness of the soup bowl, its temperature, the weight against my hand, the hand, the lifting up, the tightening of the forearms. And rather than feeling that I was being reduced to something, I felt in some ways I was becoming enhanced. It was the ideas of I had about being an individual, in some ways it was limiting me. It was constraining with idea, and wow, it was nice to put that down. And I imagine for Japanese monks, it was probably just as nice to put down the collectivist worldview they had, you know, when they're having their soup in Vipassana retreats. Just, you know, just this. And so that, you know, the deeper and stiller the mind gets, either we see how these are operating and kind of agitating or keeping the mind a little bit from being intimate and connected, or we're seeing them return. It's fascinating to watch these things return, because if you see them return, these thoughts and ideas, then they don't quite seem so absolute, or, you know, like this is the true nature of reality. They're seen more as conventions. They're seen more as constructs, and they may or may not be useful. Maybe may or may not be useful to take into account. But it's, you know, it's a phenomenal to have this kind of seeing of how views, ideas, stories, opinions operate. I did, you know, I spent, you know, I've had a, you know, kind of a strange life, or unusual. And I pretty much spent most of my adult life immersed in Buddhist culture. And a lot of it was fairly traditional Buddhist culture. And I, Vipassana practice, I went to Asia and did it there. And then I came back to California and encountered, really for the first time, the California Vipassana scene, insight scene. And it was really came really clear very quickly that this was a psychological psychological culture. The whole idea of who we are as a person, a sense of self, was organized around psychological terms, like post-Freudian psychology or Jungian psychology. I don't know what just... It had its own dynamics. We have to organize around something. So that maybe it's just as good as others, but it was so obvious to me, and it was a little bit odd because I could feel that the people living in it couldn't see it for themselves, how much they were living in psychological worldview, ideas of the person as a psychology and what's important psychologically. And you know, I certainly took in a lot of it as well, and some of it's probably unconscious now. You kind of take in what your culture is around you. And so I say all this for one purpose, or two purposes. One is to encourage you to put a question mark behind your stories. Doesn't mean you're saying they're wrong or bad, but put a question mark. And in that question mark is, it could be many things, but one of them could be, is it okay to put this down for now? Would it be okay to be just simpler and just be here without this? Without the stories and views about how I'm wrong or bad or inadequate or I can't? Put down the views of maybe it's safe and appropriate to put down some of the views about the people around you or your history or all kinds of things for the purposes of really connecting to what's here. And so with time, things start coming into focus. The clarity of this moment. Things start standing out in highlight because we're here and quiet and really see it. The kind of anecdotal story of someone at a retreat looking at candy wrapper that's on the floor and just like, wow, that's beautiful. Look at the shiny paper and the silver and the crinkles and the light. It's like psychedelic. Wow. So to bring things, you know, to start entering into the moment-to-moment experience of what's here and bring it into focus and be sensitive to receive it, be feeling it. And then the concentration part of see if you can have this, be with it more continuously. Just this. And as things come into focus, one of the things at some point, the operating idea I want to emphasize at some point, is that one of the things that becomes really obvious, because things are quiet enough, things are clear enough, we're subtle enough, there's so little projections or overlay of stories and abstractions and concepts in our experience, that we start seeing the kind of the things more at the sense level. In the sense experience, sense data, the underlying bricks by which we built the edifice of our self and society, the pixels of our experience, the sensations of touch and hearing and smelling and seeing. So it's seeing kind of right there before we construct it into something. So for example, you know, I think all of us think of this as the meditation hall. Next week, we could easily, actually, a couple of weeks ago, and I think Brian was partly responsible for this. I don't know how responsible, but I wasn't here, but I suspect. He turned this into, he cooperated, you know, and made this into a dance floor, a dance hall. He's not admitting, or you somewhere else. I don't know the full story of what really happened. So, but, you know, it was the dance room, dance hall. What? I'm the custodian of the meditation hall. When it's a meditation hall. But it wasn't then. So you come in here, are you living in meditation hall? Are you carrying that view? Or what happens if you drop one layer down into the building blocks of that? White walls, door, frame, floor, ceiling, brown, white, corners, lines, warmth, space, windows, you know, just kind of more deep, like that. So as we bring things into view and seeing it simpler and simpler and less of an overlay of ideas, at some point, what we start noticing is that there are two things happening all the time. There's the experience we're having, and there's a knowing of that experience. There's the sound of the bell, and there's something inside of you that knows that you hear the sound of the bell. Now, if the bell stops, and you start thinking about the bell for the next 5 minutes, then you've lost touch, you're no longer in touch with the direct experience. But while it's happening, there can be the immediacy of a knowing that's related to the sound of the bell. Knowing, that's the sound of a bell. And so it's actually two different things. There's the sound and the knowing of the sound. There's the hand on my thigh, I feel the warmth, and there's a knowing of the warmth. Kind of very simple, It doesn't have to be with the ordinary word, but a very simple knowing, recognizing, oh, warmth. I'm not recognizing cold, I'm recognizing, well, that's warmth. And then I feel my hand moves and I know movement. As I move it, I know smoothness over my smooth pants. And it isn't that there's work to do this. This is not like now the level of, like, I got to know all this exactly. But it's kind of a continuation of the noting or that kind of recognition of things where we drop down to a deeper place where it's more automatic. It's what the mind does. It knows things. And we see the difference between the object, the experience, and the knowing of it. And in this classic Vipassana practice, formal or official, if you want to call it, I don't know, they don't call it official, but official, I call it official for today. Vipassana begins when we start seeing with clarity that every moment there's an experience and there's knowing of it. When people are doing concentration practice by itself, they usually don't see it so clearly because there's a kind of intimacy and kind of merging, almost like emerging with experience, or almost like emerging with a subjective experience. But with stronger and stronger mindfulness, it becomes clear that there are two different things going on. And they're simultaneous, they're closely connected, they arise together. And this is considered the beginning of Vipassana practice, because when we can get this quiet and still and see this the building blocks of experience, this below the stories and ideas and opinions, that then we start seeing something very unique and special or deeper about what's going on that has not for its own sake, it isn't like this is like the way you're supposed to live, but there's something about really getting this still for a little while and doing this that really helps us to start seeing newer ways that will help you to keep shedding stories, shedding opinions and views, but more important than that, shedding attachment, shedding clinging. And that's the direction that this practice is, the purpose of this whole practice is to help the mind do this very difficult work of releasing its grasp, its craving, its clinging, the way it holds on to things. And the deepest forms of clinging are certainly hard even to see, clinging to self, clinging to survival, clinging to comfort, to opinions. There's a very deep. And so what helps give the clarity, what helps us to really see what's happening in such a way that the mind wants to release, the mind wants to kind of finally open up in the fullest possible way you can imagine. And so this path of purification is a path that's meant to provide the conditions that are supportive for the deeper and deeper and deeper releasing of the heart. The sure heart's release, some people have said. And so to temporarily be willing to suspend our involvement with a lot of the stories and ideas and concepts of self we have, to be able to kind of put aside what happened yesterday and what's going to happen tomorrow. You can always pick it up, these things up later, but for temporarily, so you can really kind of be simple, so simple that over time, with this, as you settle in, relax, the mind can get stiller and quieter, that what stands out in highlight is this the sound and the knowing of the sound. Just that. And the two are distinct, but connected. So to sit, to be still, and gaze upon all things kindly. The kind part is so important. And all things kindly is important. All of you belongs here. All of you is to be included. And it's important not to be in a hurry in the practice, hurry to get anywhere, like get deep down into the purifications. And it's important not to hurry through the building, through your day. Take your time. And enter into the samadhi of just here for the simplicity of this experience you're having now. See if you can refine your understanding of what it means to do one thing at a time. So it's really just so you really can live in the fullness of each thing that's happening, each moment. Let yourself fully belong to the experience of the moment.